This is WMNF Tampa. Time for Talking Animals.
Walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal, come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss, and this is a recorded version of Talking Animals, once again produced remotely at the corporate headquarters in Jupiter Farms, Florida. Today, I will feature two interviews I recorded in recent days. The first, which I'll air in just a moment, is with Dr. Carl Safina, the ecologist and author of several books, most recently, Becoming Wild, How Animal Cultures Raise Families, Create Beauty, and Achieve Peace. Safina has been a recipient of a MacArthur Genius Prize, as well as Pew and Guggenheim Fellowships, among many other awards. I know what you're thinking. Yeah, but does the man have anything upstairs? It seems so. His books are complex and probing, steeped in science, extended first-hand observations, and a fundamental concern for how the natural world is deteriorating and the attendant formidable challenges for the animals of that world. In the new book, Becoming Wild, Safina explores how three different species, sperm whales, scarlet macaws, and chimpanzees deal with culture, how each species learns, teaches, and creates culture. Safina goes deep and wide here, settling in for extended stays with those species, joined by top researchers of each. It all makes for a rich, fascinating read that may alter the way you think of animals, how they interact, and otherwise function. We'll hear all about the book and more when I air my interview with Dr. Carl Safina in just a moment here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Also, as you probably know, WMNF has been gradually and very carefully bringing back programmers to broadcast directly from the station. As part of that schedule, I'm tentatively due back in the WMNF studio on June 24th. I'm really looking forward to it. Also, ordinarily around this time in June, we'd be in the midst of the summer fun drive. We'll still be holding one, but given the social distancing and other precautions we're observing at the station, we can't do a conventional fun drive. Only 10 people total are allowed in the entire station currently, so we can't assemble our usual crew of fun drive phone answerers and other volunteers. So we'll be improvising with a gradual fun drive spread out over the coming weeks. More details to come, but if you'd like to support Talking Animals in the meantime, please go to the Talking Animals tip jar on WMNF.org or email me directly at Duncan@WMNF.org. Meanwhile, later in today's program, I'll air another interview I recorded recently, this one with Gail Carroll, who with her husband Paul is a longtime puppy raiser, helping these canines prepare to become guide dogs under the umbrella of Southeastern Guide Dog. I should note, Carroll's also maintained a longtime affiliation with WMNF. I got to thinking recently that a central aspect of being a puppy raiser is taking the dog to a wide range of places and settings, stores, restaurants, ball games, airports, radio stations, among others. So what happens when the COVID-19 restrictions keep puppy raisers from taking their assigned dog to almost all those places? Answers to that question and general information about puppy raisers will be offered when I air that conversation with Gail Carroll later in today's program. Right now, in an interview recorded Monday about his new book, Becoming Wild, this is Carl Safina on Talking Animals on WMNF. Thanks for joining us again on the show.
Well, always a great pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, well, congratulations on the new book, which has been received with great enthusiasm and drawn glowing reviews. We spoke in 2015 when you had just published Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. And in reading Becoming Wild, I wondered to what extent the new book could be seen as something of a sequel to Beyond Words, a deeper dive in the overused parlance.
Well, you could see it as a sequel. I don't really see it that way. The way I thought of it was more of a follow-on, that there were some things in Beyond Words that I couldn't really get as into, just for matters of length and detail,
yeah.
That seemed to rate a book of their own. And that was the major topic of culture in other animals. culture in non-humans, and I wanted to get into that. And as I was working on the book, I think that book, to me anyway, it pulled away from my previous book, Beyond Words, and became even more of its own book, a standalone thing, than I had even planned at the outset.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, that kind of brings me to a slight chicken or egg question. So when formulating the idea for one of your books, but let's say specifically for Becoming Wild, did you think, hey, I want to explore animal cultures in a rich, meaningful way. Now, which animals should I zero in on to most effectively develop that narrative? Or did you already have notes in a file somewhere that it says, okay, at some point, I'd really like to study in greater detail and in person sperm whales, scarlet macaws, the chimpanzees, and then decide to kind of fasten those objectives together?
It was more the former.
Yeah.
It wasn't really working off notes I already had in a file. I do have a file of ideas. It's more like a list of ideas for possible books.
Right.
And that was probably one of them. I actually don't exactly remember how it emerged, but I think that the idea solidified from a number of things I had been reading and thinking about and writing about.
Right. Well, yeah, I guess I meant more, not necessarily strictly literally a file with those ideas, but just that in your mind you might have been thinking, well, here are some animals that I'm interested in, love to spend some time with, and this does connect to kind of this idea that I'm working around in my head about cultures and exploring those. So I
Well, it was the animals followed the idea rather than the idea following the animals. With one exception, though, the middle part of the book about macaws, macaws are not known or thought of or really studied as cultural animals. But I just was very, very intrigued by them, having seen them in Peru on a previous trip, and noting that even though I used to study birds, wild free living birds for a living, mostly seabirds, and so I have an eye for birds, and I've never seen any other kind of bird do what macaws do all the time, which is in a flock they are obviously paired up, so that if you see 12 macaws flying, it's usually obvious that it's six pairs of two. And I've never seen any other bird where you can easily see who is with who inside the flock. So I wanted to go back. I strongly suspected that it would be pretty rich if I started scratching that, and it turned out to be.
Yeah. Well, and they're very interesting. I was probably least familiar with the macaws coming into your book of the animals that you really focused on. And I came away quite enchanted with them because they're, as you say, the way they pair up like that. But just their personalities and their apparent love of hanging out and...
Yeah.
And, but of course, a big part of the section revolves around beauty. And so maybe, could you talk a little bit more, since we're sort of onto macaws at this point, about just that idea of beauty and who either creates or assesses beauty, especially relative to macaws, but maybe more broadly?
Yeah, sure. Well, first of all, more broadly, when Darwin was talking about the mechanism of evolution, he first came up with natural selection, which is basically that the environment, the physical and the living environment, are basically a filter, and it's very hard to survive, and the ones who don't quite have it don't survive, so they don't get to reproduce. And that could explain easily something like camouflage, right? If you are hard to see, you're more likely to survive than if you stand out. So that was good. That works for a lot of things, but Darwin said that his own idea could never explain something like a peacock, or for that matter, basically all the other male birds that are really bright and really showy. There must be another mechanism going on. And so in addition to what he called natural selection, he came up with what he called sexual selection, which is that it's the males that get the chance to breed are the ones that have the look that the females want to see, and that look is a thing that is arbitrary, but it's specific to each species. So a male cardinal looks red, a male oriole looks like an oriole, etc., on down the line. And those two things accounted for a lot of what we see in the diversity of the living world. Many people don't really think of sexual selection. They kind of have never heard of it, or they lump it in with natural selection. It's a very, very different kind of thing. And And the biggest difference is that in that case, you actually have living things choosing the look that they want, which is a very, you know, if you realize it that way, it's kind of a very radical view of the world. Now, with the macaws, it's not just males that are really showy. It's males and females that are equally showy. And so what that says is that these birds have an aesthetic sense that they've been choosing. And further, the macaws are by far the biggest of the parrots in the New World, in the Western Hemisphere. But there are dozens of parrot species, and all the rest of them are basically the color of leaves. They're basically all green and camouflaged. But when the macaws, for some reason, got big enough to basically be too big for most of the hawks that might catch a smaller parrot, they exploded with color. So the macaws are, they just look like a fruit cocktail, and none of the other parrots do. And the main difference between them and the other parrots is they're just basically big enough to not have to worry too much about getting eaten by something. And so it's almost as if there's this aesthetic pressure within life, that life prefers and chooses beauty, and it explodes into being in these macaws. And I think, you know, macaws are basically, they're a very good example of what I'm talking about, and they're the creature in the book that led me into all of these thoughts. But once you start looking around with that idea in mind, you see other examples of that kind of thing, and you realize that, yes, much of the physical beauty in the living world is not a practical day-to-day survival kind of beauty, the way that camouflage is, or the way that, you know, having sharp claws is if you're a cat, but it's just purely aesthetic. And I find that to be like, it's like turning a page on a whole new chapter in understanding what's going on in life. So that if you start looking closely at a lot of animals, even if you look at, let's say, the eyes of a leopard or a jaguar, or then you start looking at many other animals and realizing the same thing, they're lined with either black or white. You know, they look made up, and these things are I believe purely aesthetic things. And I think that many animals have an aesthetic sense that they use in choosing mates. We know this is very true with the birds, in which only the male is showy, but I think it goes much, much wider than that.
Yeah, and it's interesting as you note that the macaws, both genders, are really beautiful in that way and striking, but also, as you mentioned along the way there, that it's not as it would be in maybe other species, putting them in a vulnerable spot as much, because their sheer size makes them less vulnerable, I guess, really, to predators, even though their colors and their beauty would otherwise be attention grabbing.
That's correct, yes. I believe that is exactly what's going on.
Yeah, really interesting. And I want to get to a number of other things in our short time here, but I just want to, before we leave possibly the subject of birds, maybe we'll come back to them, but I have to at least briefly hit on bowerbirds, which,
yeah.
Just because I was not familiar with those before. I mean, there's courtship rituals, and then there's courtship rituals. I mean, that is something quite unusual. Maybe you could just briefly touch on that for folks who aren't familiar or haven't yet had a chance to read the book.
Yeah, that may be the extreme in courtship rituals in birds.
Yeah.
And the best example of a purely aesthetic sense in non-human animals. Bowerbirds are a number of species. I think there's around 20. It says in the book, I can't remember. I think it's around 20 species. And they build what's called bowers that are sometimes like huts, sometimes like a walled lane with an open roof. They are structures that are mostly made of thousands of twigs, and then they are just remarkably decorated, where some species of bowerbird like to decorate with things that are blue, some like to decorate with things that are red, and if you go in and you mess with their decorations, they'll put it back the way they wanted it. Now, the bower, this is really the thing that really clinches it as far as this being purely aesthetic. The bower is not their nest at all. The bower is only a seduction theater
where the male courts the female and the female assesses the male by how good his bower is and whether she likes it. And then if she does like it, the only contribution the male makes to their breeding is mating. And then the female goes and makes a nest and she incubates the eggs alone. So these birds that are named for these remarkable structures, their bowers, are engaging in all this stuff for reasons that are based purely on aesthetic.
Yeah, I mean, it's really remarkable, because it would still be kind of striking if the mating actually did take place there. But the fact that it's just like, look at what I've built here, and look at the colors and the construction and the decorations and whatever. But otherwise, if this works, we're not going to have anything to do with it after that. I mean, that's...
Right, right.
That's really...
Right, and she may say, nice try.
Right, yeah.
Work on it for a few more years, because I'm going to go check out this other guy who's more mature and he knows what he's doing.
Yeah.
And that's actually what happened.
No, it's really... It's so... I mean, this is one of the things that makes animals just generally so awe-inspiring, that there's a story like this and how that actually worked. And that indeed, that the one we're talking about, the hypothetical one we're talking about, might do some more work on their bower, and then maybe down the road, maybe she will find it just exactly what she's looking for.
Right. And the younger males watch the older male to learn what they need to do to be sexy.
Yeah. Yeah, they're watching their own home improvement channels, I guess, of some
kind. Yeah.
So this is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest is Carl Serafina, whose new book is Becoming Wild, How Animal Cultures Raise Families, Create Beauty, and Achieve Peace. This interview was recorded Monday. So I want to get on to chimps, but I want to at least spend a moment, of course, on some whales, too. I mean, there were so many things that, as we talked about with the bowerbirds, that just filled me with wonder and underscored the awe of why animals inspire me and why I just love to talk about them with people like you. So when looking at, in the sperm whale section, I mean, there is a number of things that were interesting, but can you talk a little bit about the songs sperm whales, like when it comes to clans and how they're sort of unique to that clan, and so to the extent where another clan wouldn't have the same kind of song, but then the songs change, but they still remain singular? I mean, that just seemed really captivating to me as well.
Yeah, well, the humpback whale is the greatest singer among the whales, and their songs last for maybe 20 minutes or so, and they are songs because they're constructed identically. They always sing the same song when they're singing. It's got a pattern, and then when they're done, they repeat it. But the amazing thing is that every year the song changes, and every male humpback whale in that particular ocean, whether it's the Atlantic or the Pacific or the Indian, every whale in each ocean sings the same song, but the song changes every year, and it's different in each ocean. So it's a purely cultural thing. It's like a hit song. You know, somebody innovates somehow, and then they all learn to sing it. And there's, I was about to say there's nothing else like that, but there probably are other things like that. There's nothing else like that that I know of, and they certainly do sing the most elaborate songs. Now, there are some other whales that also sing what's called songs, and those songs are much shorter. They're not as they're not nearly as obvious or as haunting, and you know, so the humpback is the extreme that we know of.
But isn't it wild that over time, over X amount of years or whatever, you'd think if you applied some other kind of logic that clearly doesn't really apply, but that just by chance a clan might stumble onto the same song or same kind of song that a previous clan had. But the fact that they're always totally different, even as they change from period to period.
Right, and they're obviously paying close attention to each other.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's really interesting stuff. So, now, this may be a rhetorical question, but how do you feel about matriarchal animal societies, and how did working on the book affect your view, if at all?
Well, the societies in which the females are always the most dominant are much more peaceful.
Right.
And the females often use dominance to stop fighting and make things peaceful. So how I feel about them is it's a good thing. it would be nice if we could, you know, elevate those kinds of nonviolent sensibilities and maybe squelch more of the violent chimpanzee within us.
Right. Well, no, that's true, because, well, the third section of the book is the achieved peace section, and really does deals with a number of animals, but the focus, of course, is the chimpanzees in Uganda. So that section is rich and textured, as, you know, are the other two sections. That's sort of the Safina way. But it feels like you become kind of weary, maybe even exasperated, with the way the chimps that you profile are often doing battle or jockeying for position or trying to become the alpha male or recognize who is the alpha male. And
well, that's actually true. And in fact, chimps were never high on my list of animals to try to see in the wild, because everything I read about them, they just reminded me a little bit too much of not the best things in human beings.
Yeah.
And so they, you know, they weren't really that high on my list. And then when I went and we saw them, and I was there for several weeks, I was with a researcher who most of the time she was studying gestural communication, how they communicate with gestures. And that means she wanted to go places where there were going to be the most interactions. And there's the most interaction if you hang around where the males are hanging around. So we would always try to find the older, more dominant males and try to hang around with the alpha male and his entourage. And I got a slightly skewed view of chimpanzee society, because I was seeing a really male aspect of chimp culture more than the average day-to-day for most of the chimps most of the time. And I did get tired of all the bluster, all of the jockeying, all of the politicking, and you know, the chasing, the threats of violence, the dominance, the suppression of the younger males. It just, you know, they made their lives a lot less pleasant than those lives needed to be.
Right. Well,
when we went then to hang out with females, I realized that, oh, you know what, it's not always like that for chimps, because the females are just much more chill. They just don't do all of that kind of stuff. And then I also learned that not even all chimpanzees are like that. That in West Africa, Uganda's in East Africa, in West Africa, there are chimps that are a lot mellower. The most dominant individual in those chimps in West Africa are male, but they're not so obsessed with their status as the ones in East Africa are. So that's a cultural thing also. They learn how to be that way. And that means, of course, that they could learn how to be a different way. If you took an East African baby chimp and somehow were able to get it raised in the West African culture, it would just learn that culture. And I think there's some hope for humanity in that. You know, we could learn better ways to be. We're not stuck being the way we are right now. And at this particular point in time, with what's happening in America and in the news, you can see that we have a lot of improvement as far as acceptance and as far as being more peaceful, less prone to trying to dominate others.
Yeah. Well, a couple things there. One is about just the males, and especially in that area where it was probably disproportionately male, maybe. At one point, you write that the chimps create problems for themselves. They're vain, and vanity is male, which that was kind of a powerful observation, I thought. So
that kind of vanity is male, yes.
Yeah.
You know, it's not an aesthetic vanity. It's a dominant vanity.
Right. And then, as you're noting, I mean, I happen to be finishing the book when George Floyd was killed, and so I was reading the chimp section when various forms of violence erupted on the streets of this country. And some of the scenes you described resonated suddenly in a kind of very eerie way, beyond just how upsetting they were at face value.
So, right. You know, I was having a conversation with a woman named Lori Marino. She's a neuroscientist.
I know her. She's been on the show.
Okay.
Yeah.
So at one point, this was a few years ago, maybe 3 years ago or so. It was not connected to this book at all. But
okay.
She said, I don't remember what we were talking about. I think it had to have been something about male dominance impulses or something like that. And probably chimpanzees, because she said, imagine chimpanzees if they had automatic weapons. And then she paused for a beat and she said, well, that's us. And wow. I found that really rather chilling.
Oh, yeah. Yikes. Yeah, that's that is chilling. Man. Yeah, well, that makes you, sometimes you think, well, why can't we and others be more like the bonobo, I guess, right?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And in fact, I wrote an article you can find on the web. It's called, I think the exact title is The Sexy Happy Ape We Might Have Been. And just saying that, you know, it's an kind of an accident that we live in a male-dominated, where our species tends to be male-dominant, and that the males tend to dominate by force, because in another species that we are equally related to, the bonobos, which are almost exactly like chimpanzees on the surface, they look very much like chimpanzees, but they're a different species, the dominant individual in any bonobo group is always female,
yeah.
And they simply don't hurt each other. And when chimpanzee groups meet other groups of chimpanzees, there's a territorial clash that can turn fatal. That never happens in bonobos. Usually they either check each other out and then just go back into their own territory, or they mingle. Sometimes they mingle with an orgy to go with it, just to make sure everybody is good. And that's in stark contrast. And and we are exactly as related to bonobos as we are to chimpanzees. So,
yeah.
In a way, you know, it's just like, wow, we missed.
Right.
We missed having a totally different way of being.
And isn't it interesting in that same way that bonobos are a very singular society and sort of a small culture, to use your word of the book, found in just a very isolated place, and that's it. That's it for bonobos. So,
yeah. Right.
There must be something there that,
nobody knows really what the underlying reason is about why they're that way. It could be just by chance. It started that way and it got locked in, just like male dominance can get locked in. Or it might have been something more ecological. Some people have suggested that where bonobos live, there is just a lot more food all the time, so there's a lot less reason. There's no reason for groups to be territorial with each other and fight over territory, because everybody has enough, which is the main reason for fighting over territory, is to protect your food and your other resources. So that's just a suggestion. Nobody knows for sure, though.
Yeah. Well, they are the sort of classic make love, not war counterparts. So there's something to be said there, for sure.
Yeah.
So one, speaking of something more upbeat, one universal quality you seem to encounter in your travels for the book is the importance of play. And I think it's in the macaw section where you note that animals play because it feels good. So, I mean, it's hard to argue that point, but what are some of the ways that we, or the researchers that specialize in those animals, determine that, so that it, I mean, it makes sense, and it would certainly be hard to argue, but how do we know that that's how the animals feel about it?
Well, it's sort of logical inference, and what other explanation can fit, or what other explanation fits as well, and really no other explanation fits as well. Play almost always, maybe always, involves physical skills that basically help develop the skills that you would need in life anyway, and just general surviving. You know, there's like chasing and pouncing and grabbing. You know, if you're a chimpanzee and you're running around and you have to scramble up trees and swing around on vines because you're chasing each other, well, you have to be very good at doing that on a day-to-day basis when you grow up, because that's what you have to do to live if you're a chimpanzee. If you're a wolf, you chase, you tackle, you wrestle, and those are the skills you're going to need. But what would make you do that if there's no other thing motivating you, if you're not actually trying to kill something, or you're not actually climbing a tree to get food? Well, it has to feel good. Otherwise, I can't conceive of another reason. And you can easily see that when these animals are doing it, they're having fun. Why do we know they're having fun? Because they're chuckling, they have their play faces on. They very much know the difference between somebody who's chasing them trying to hurt them and somebody who's chasing them just to have a good time, because there's a lot of handicapping that goes into it. You know, I'm not going to hit you or bite you as hard as I can because we're playing, and we both understand that. That is universal in play. It's very easy to see that in basically the one species that people in our culture know best, which is dogs.
Sure. Makes sense. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss, and I'm speaking with Carl Serfina, marine ecologist and author, most recently of Becoming Wild, How Animal Cultures Raise Families, Create Beauty, and Achieve Peace. This interview was recorded Monday. So as you were describing that, Dr. Serfina, I remember that somewhere, I think it was pretty early in the book, and it was kind of an aside about anthropomorphizing, and and there seems to be an ongoing debate in people who study animals and animal behavior, but there were times as I got through the end of this book where I thought, not that you intended it this way, but it felt like you could sort of see this book as kind of a big raised middle finger to the people who dismiss the idea of anthropomorphizing animals and assigning those kinds of qualities and behaviors to animals. Is that...
Well, I'm not sure that I would want to affront anybody as much as I would like to disabuse them of what I think is a very mistaken notion.
Yeah.
The mistaken notion is that humans are the only ones that have any and all human emotion and human logic, that other animals act in ways that are completely logical and totally make sense, and they're motivated by many of the same emotions that we inherited. We didn't invent fear or lust or hunger or defensiveness. We inherited those things from other animals, just like we inherited our skeleton, our organ, our nervous system. So why we would say that another animal has a skeleton or another animal has a heart and lung, but only humans have any emotions, is very strange to me, when obviously a lot of animals have emotions. They run from danger because it scares them.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's just very obvious. And the people who study free-living animals do not have any kind of hang-up about this idea at all. And they're not really concerned with anthropomorphism. In fact, many of them, their best first guess at what an animal is doing is to compare it to what a human would do in similar circumstances.
Yeah.
Which is very logical. It's who I find is most hung up about it are science writers who are not actually scientists and were simply trained when they were young that you're not allowed to do this, say this, or think this way. And you know, in science, there shouldn't be, and in real science, there aren't rules about what you're allowed to say, do, or think. You're supposed to investigate and go where data and logic lead you. Data and logic make up science.
Yeah.
Now, you know, there are a lot of because science is practiced by people, and people are imperfect. There are people who have rules and are kind of stuck up about things, but it's not supposed to work that way in science. What's supposed to happen in science is you look carefully, you take notes or measure or study in some formal way, and then you try to explain what you've seen in a way that hopefully is correct.
Yeah.
And that's how it's supposed to work. The thing that has rules about what you're not allowed to think or say is not science, and that's the great and freeing thing about science, is that you really can continue to learn about the way the world actually is, and we certainly have a lot to learn about that.
Right. Well, that's the thing. I mean, it's almost like a parallel to the scientific method itself, that as you get out and you study things and see animals and study, really, like you kind of, at least for this book, if not otherwise too, kind of embed, really, with scientists that have these specialties, you know, Shane Garrow with the sperm whales and so on. So you really get, you're not just there for a brief time and say, all right, well, this kind of what I saw on Wednesday, but this is what I saw over time. So when you're seeing those things and you're thinking, well, this is how they're reacting, they are displaying grief, or that poor mother chimp is carrying around the dead infant for a number of days. I mean, at that point, if you're not seeing emotions and other behavior that, yeah, you might attribute to humans, I'm not sure what else you would arrive at, what other conclusion you would arrive at.
Yeah, nothing that really makes any sense,
yeah.
Actually.
Yeah. So, all right. So we know better, Dr. Savine. I think that's what we're saying here, right?
So we hope so.
Yeah, that's right. So we have just about reached the end of our time. We've been speaking with Dr. Carl Savine. The new book is Becoming Wild, How Animal Cultures Raise Families, Create Beauty, and Achieve Peace, which you can get wherever you get your book. And you can find out more either at carlsafina.org. It's SAFINA.org or safinacenter.org. And so, Dr. Savine, thank you so much for making the time again to join us on Talking Animals.
Oh, well, I'm always honored to have you spend some time with me, so it's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. In a moment, I'll play back my conversation with Gail Carroll, partly addressing the challenges of serving as a puppy raiser, given that a major part of that responsibility involves taking the puppy to stores, restaurants, airports, and other locations where people gather when COVID-19 restrictions have largely ruled out access to those places. Right now, though, we're going to step into the Comedy Corner. This is a piece by Tom Shalhoub called Animal Shows in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals on WMNF.
I like my animal shows, right? You like the animal shows?
Yeah.
Guys like animal shows, right? Come on, we work all day, we want to go home, we want to watch animals eat other animals. It relaxes us, I don't know why. I've noticed something, I watch these shows all the time though. Don't they always try to make you feel guilty? Just for being human? They give you that human guilt trip at the end of the show. No matter what species of animal it is, they always come in with a deep voice at the end of the show when the sun is setting. The guy's like, the snow leopard has but one natural enemy. Man. Like, I'm killing the snow leopard. I don't even know what it is. I saw this the other night. I got home on TV. This is what's on TV. The condor. The condor is flying in slow motion over the Grand Canyon. And the guy with the deep voice is like, the condor used to have the Grand Canyon to himself until the white man came. I'm like, oh, you gotta make it racial, huh? Like the condor cares about that? Like there's some black guy hiking in the Grand Canyon, the condor's like, you're okay, dude. It's the white man I got a problem with.
That was Tom Shalhoub with a piece called Animal Shows, taken from his album Overconfident. Now it's time to hear my conversation with Gail Carroll about puppy raising amidst a pandemic that prevents the raisers from taking their assigned dog to the usual places that are part of the training. I should also note that Gail and her husband Paul have been involved with WNF in various roles for many years. Recorded Thursday, this is Gail Carroll on Talking Animals on WMNF. Thanks for joining us on the show, Gail.
It's nice to be here, Duncan.
Great. So you and your husband Paul are puppy raisers for Southeastern Guide Dogs. How long have you been doing this?
We have been involved since about 2012.
Okay.
Was when we started to get involved.
And so I guess the fundamental question we should get to almost immediately is, what does a puppy raiser do?
What a puppy raiser does, I'll try and keep it somewhat brief, because once I get going, sometimes I just keep going.
Sure.
But what a puppy raiser does is we are responsible for taking the puppies when they're roughly 10 weeks of age, and it varies depending on a lot of factors. But at around 10 weeks of age, we bring a puppy home, and we then proceed to go to a puppy kindergarten class every week for 6 weeks. We begin to teach the puppy basic house manners, and our job for the next year roughly is to teach house manners, socialize the puppy, teach them a basic set of commands so that they can execute those commands in your home and then later out in more distracting environment, and effectively to end up with a puppy at about 14 months of age that is oblivious to any sounds or sight or people or enticements and who is totally focused on his or her handler.
Before I get into the specifics of that, because this is in some ways why we're chatting today in terms of things that might have disrupted that ideal game plan, how if someone's listening, and they'll probably become more interested as we chat more, but just so we be sure to get this in our short talk here today, how can someone look into becoming a puppy raiser if this sounds intriguing to them?
Oh, thank you for that question. Duncan. It's a very simple process, and you really don't even have to know a single thing about raising a dog in order to become a puppy raiser. You just have to have the desire. And so the easiest way to find out about it is to visit the website for Southeastern Guide Dogs, and you can find that at guidedogs.org. And on there is a very prominent tab that says Become a Puppy Raiser. And if you are interested, you can fill out an application, and you will be contacted then by an area coordinator who is responsible for a group of puppy raisers in a geographic region. For example, in Pinellas County, which is a very large county here in Florida, we have 5 puppy raiser groups. And you end up going to meeting twice a month with your group of fellow puppy raisers and the puppies that are being raised in that group. And so we want to make it convenient so that people don't have to travel for hours to get somewhere. The short answer is you go to the website, you fill out the application to become a puppy raiser, someone gets in touch with you, and you get invited to attend meetings.
Sounds simple.
It is very simple.
Great. All right, so that little detour, but I think it was important because, again, as we talk more, and even people who might have been mulling this over and saying, you know, that looks like kind of a cool thing to do, and as we get our chat going, maybe even more so I'm glad that we hit on that. But so let's circle back from where we left off before the information on how to become a puppy raiser with what the task is that you've outlined and for how long a period, the year or so that you're with that puppy, and what the sort of objectives are. Because for most of this pandemic period, I've been asking many of the guests on the show, whether they've been with shelters, sanctuaries, animal-oriented businesses, and so on, what sort of impact COVID-19 has had on what they do. And there's been, of course, an interesting array of answers and adaptations. But it occurred to me the other day, which is why I wanted to invite you on the show today, that a central aspect of being a puppy raiser, although there's a lot of things that you've noted that happen at home and teaching and refining good manners there, etc., but over time at least, you're also supposed to really, as I understand it, be out and about to stores and restaurants and ball games and airports, flights, even radio stations, whatever, so that they're getting used to things, habituated to all kinds of things, and as you said at the end of your description, so they're kind of oblivious to sounds and sights and other things that, having not done so, might unsettle your average dog. So when the pandemic limited all that, I'd be very interested to know, because I think overlapping that, you had your latest puppy, Zappa, arrive, right? When did Zappa arrive, in fact?
Zappa arrived in our home around mid-March,
okay. And
he was born in late January. So he was not a very old puppy and a very tiny puppy.
Yeah.
We had originally intended to get him in April, and then when the pandemic hit, we said, well, why not go ahead and get a puppy now?
I see.
And of course, Southeastern was very interested in getting all of the puppies placed, because as the pandemic took hold and with social distancing requirements, of course, the school could not have in-person classes, and they were not doing tours of the facilities, and most of the people were working at home. And as it ended up, only the puppies who were there at the school with their mothers, having just been born, were the only dogs on campus.
And also, I would think, from what you described earlier in the how to become a puppy raiser section, that those nice meetings that you described that happened sort of organized by geography were, I assume, curtailed, at least temporarily. And I don't know if that went to Zoom or something else, but I assume the meetings where people would get together and talk about puppy raising and have their puppies there and whatever had to be suspended for the time being.
Absolutely. And in fact, those meetings are still not going on.
Yeah.
We have very strict guidelines from the school, who are following the CDC guidelines, of course, about no large group meeting. And so what we've had to eliminate from our normal practice of puppy raising is we're not doing meetings twice a month. So we don't all get together. And what that does is it's not only a nice socialization for the raisers, and especially for a new raiser to learn from experienced raisers.
Sure.
But it's also an essential thing to get the puppies used to being around other puppies and still behaving, still being able to execute their commands.
Right.
But as we know, dogs are pack animals, so the natural thing they want to do is get together and play and have a good time.
Right.
And there's a time and a place for that, but it's not at meetings. Meetings are about obedience and about learning how to go to places like the mall and grocery stores and the buses and airports, as you mentioned. So we have no meetings, we have no group outings, and we can't allow the puppies to be greeted by people, which is another essential skill to teach the puppies how to do it properly and not jump on someone, right? They need to be able to be calm and sit and be greeted and petted. But it also helps to teach the puppies that people are good. Tons of people are good, and you should be happy to see people. But it's a really interesting thing when we can go into places like grocery stores, and in the old days, pre-virus, when we could have people come up and greet the puppy. So the puppy's in a more distracting environment than he is normally. A stranger is coming up to them, and maybe you're just stopping to talk to the stranger. And the puppy needs to learn things like, okay, when this happens, I just go in a down position, which means they just go down on the floor and they're just calm. So it's a real developmental thing for the puppy. So when we can't do all of those things, the school got really creative, I have to say. To begin with, since we got Zappa, he had to go to puppy kindergarten. Now, I'm a puppy kindergarten teacher for our group, so technically I could have just taught our puppy everything that he needed to know.
Yeah.
But there's another aspect, again, back to the socialization. When you're doing a puppy kindergarten class normally in person, you have multiple puppies and their raisers coming to these very small group sessions and learning together. And that's the initial way that we teach the puppies. No, at a meeting, which is what a kindergarten is, you don't get to go and play with that puppy. We're here to learn. And so that starts very, very early, and these puppies missed all of that. But what the school did was they started doing kindergarten via Facebook Live.
Okay.
And so everybody that had a new puppy would tune in at a certain time, and we could also review it later because they saved it on a YouTube channel for us all to look at. We could all follow along with the puppy kindergarten. And in the case of Zappa, we're doing something a little bit different. We are co-raising Zappa, which means we're sharing him between two families, kind of like joint custody of a puppy.
Yeah.
So what we did was we would all watch the Facebook Live presentation by the regional manager on each week for the puppy kindergarten sessions, and then we would have our own Zoom session between us and our co-raisers.
Oh, wow, neat. Okay, yeah.
So we did a double lesson, and then we practiced all week, and then like we typically would do in a regular puppy kindergarten session. So we practice all week, but what was really helpful was because we couldn't be there in person, it's really helpful to say, okay, the puppy is doing this and I don't know why. And so we'd say, okay, all right, let's look at this. Show us what you're doing. Okay, you're reaching for your treat too soon, or you're not positioning this puppy the proper way. And so it was a really great way to interactively help our co-raisers along in the process.
Yeah.
They also had virtual troubleshooting sessions for anybody going through puppy kindergarten. So if you were having a problem with your puppy, you'd come on. It was a Zoom session, so it would be interactive, and they'd set up separate rooms so that the trainers and regional managers could help with individual problems that were being experienced by raisers. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say that as we sort of were talking about a little bit before we officially went on the air, that the pandemic and all the restrictions thereof, so many cases have made people and organizations and companies and whatever so adaptive and creative and improvising around the limitations that the COVID-19 has imposed. And this just sounds like yet another example. I mean, there's so many things that would normally happen for a dog that's in puppy raising stage that obviously as we've addressed cannot happen. But these ideas about how to shore up at least some of those gaps are really, really interesting. And again, in some ways, almost a boon to Zappa, maybe compared to some, that you guys are co-raising Zappa so that there's almost sort of additional classroom and kindergarten action that there might not have been for a dog that was just raised by one family.
That's right. And in his other family, there is another dog and there are three cats. And we don't have other pets in our family.
Okay.
So the circumstances in the different households make it an effective way of starting the socialization. And the creativity, I want to get back to the creativity of Southeastern because
sure.
I'm so impressed with it. So because we can't do two meetings a month in our group, Southeastern is doing two virtual meetings a month, and they're covering specific skills and then inviting everyone to practice those skills and to reach out if they have any questions, and they've offered all kinds of troubleshooting sessions. If you're having any sort of problems with your puppies, let us know. We will get you in line for, you know, help on these troubleshooting sessions, and we'll help you do things. But other things that come out from Southeastern, and I sent you one of these, Duncan,
yeah.
is
I was going to ask some things about it. Yeah,
calendar challenges, which is really an interesting way to keep raisers connected and keep puppies trained and keep them getting trained. So a calendar challenge is something very simple each day. For example, put your puppy in a down state and walk around them 3 times in a circle and make sure that they stay.
Well, I really responded. And, I was just going to say real quickly, I should have said this before. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest is Gail Carroll, who with her husband Paul is a longtime puppy raiser, helping these canines prepare to become guide dogs for Southeastern Guide Dogs. Carroll's also maintained a longtime affiliation with WMNF, and this interview was recorded Thursday. So I didn't mean to cut you off, but I mean, some of the things that I had picked out to talk, and we're sort of nearing the end of our time here, Gail, struck me as particularly geared for things that would sort of help supplant what couldn't happen by, again, not being able to go out and about and be exposed to certain sounds or experiences. But go ahead. You mentioned one or two. Maybe I'll mention one or two that grabbed my eye, too.
Okay. Well, I mean, the calendar challenges are just simple ways for everyone to keep in practice, to make sure that the puppies remain getting trained in some fashion every day. And out of these calendar challenges and the virtual meetings, we get really wonderful suggestions because the trainers know that the puppies aren't getting socialized in the same way. So they've made suggestions to us like, go and sit with your puppy in the driveway. That's driveway socialization. So you take a chair out, you've got your bottle of water, you've got your puppy on a leash, and you just sit there and you watch the world go by. You watch people walk by, you watch dogs walk by, cars and trucks, lawnmowers, blowers, bird sounds. All of these things really help the puppy just kind of learn how to be calm even when strange things might be happening around you, especially for a young puppy.
Yeah.
That can be a little intimidating. Other things they've told us to do is make sure that you put your puppy in his puppy coat every day and go somewhere. Put him in the car. Mm. Get him out of the car.
Yeah.
Go to a park. So we've been doing socialization as we can safely. So we go to park. We have, we do things called buddy walk. We can only have 2 puppies together at a time under the current guidelines. So 2 puppies and 2 raisers, it's permitted with a mask on to go and walk along next to one another, to go out to an outdoor location and have the puppies at least be exposed to another puppy in a coat.
Yeah.
Another, and learn how to walk along together. We've done things like we've gone to Publix, and for a brand new puppy, going to Publix is a huge thing, so you have to do it very, very slowly.
Sure.
So we go into Publix only when it's not busy, sit at the front of the Publix and just watch the world go by, get the puppy to step on and get weighed on the scale, which is a fun activity because as the puppy grows and you go to your usual Publix, all the cashiers are going, how much does he weigh now? Where is he now? And everybody thinks it's adorable. So we do those kinds of things. So we're able to do some level of socialization. It's not the same, but it's what we can do.
Yeah.
So that's what we're doing.
That's great. Well, we're sort of at the very end of our time and then maybe a little bit past that at this point, but it's so interesting. So let me just ask you one final question, if I could, Gail. So with that in mind and all the improvisation and really cool creative ideas that you've mentioned, compared to what you outlined at the beginning of our talk about the normal timetable about when the puppies then would go back and then resume their training, does this, the limitations of COVID-19, alter the timetable at all?
Well, I think it is going to alter the timetable simply by understanding that if we cannot have classes to match these puppies with visually impaired people, then we have a lot of puppies that are out here that are ready, perhaps, to be matched that can't be. So we end up with more puppies in the pipeline than the pipeline can spit out the other end.
Yeah.
If I can use that as an analogy.
I think so. Yeah.
So it is certainly expected that the puppies are going to be with raisers for at least a couple months longer than they typically would.
Yeah.
And as the school starts to have classes, they're not going to have in-person classes right away, but instead are having much smaller classes.
Mm-hmm.
They're taking fewer puppies in each month once we start to take puppies back into college, which is what we refer to it as.
Right.
And so that's naturally going to be a restrictor, if you will, on the number of puppies that can get through the pipeline and get out to people who need their help.
Gotcha. Well, this to me is super fascinating as just yet another offshoot of what happens when there's the limitations that we've all experienced with COVID-19. But this has all kinds of implications and ripple effects, and it's been fascinating to hear about many of them. So this has been Gail Carroll. And again, she's a puppy raiser for Southeastern Guide Dogs. And if you want to find out more, including how you too might become a puppy raiser, you just go to guidedogs.org and find that information right there on their fabulous website. So, Gail, thanks so much for filling us in today on Talking Animals. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Duncan. And it's been a lot of fun, and we need all the puppy raisers we can get. So all thank right. you so much.
Thank you. I'm Duncan Strauss, and you're listening to Talking Animals. Coming up at 11 on WMNF, it's Rob Lori with Radioactivity. Meanwhile, on this show at the moment, as the prize for Name That Animal Tune, I'll be offering a Talking Animals t-shirt. As a reminder, we do Name That Animal Tune differently these days. Rather than call if you know the tune, please email me at duncan@wmnf.org with your guess of the song title. Again, a Talking Animals t-shirt to the first person who emails duncan@wmnf.org and correctly identifies this animal song. It's Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals on WMNF. We reach the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Our website is talkinganimals.net. Stay tuned for Rob Lori. This is Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weekiwachee, and beyond.